Harding versus Walls. Ms. Osterberger.
Have a moment. May it please the court, counsel. Good morning. My name is Domenica Osterberger. I'm an assistant Illinois attorney general, and I'm appearing on behalf of the respondent in this case, Jonathan Walls. Respondent appeals in this matter from an order of the district court granting habeas corpus relief to the petitioner. The grant of relief was premised on the theory that the prosecution at trial knowingly allowed false testimony to stand uncorrected at petitioner's trial. Petitioner was found guilty of residential burglary and murder in Rock Island, Illinois. The murder was of his mentally impaired paternal cousin. The prosecution's main witness at trial was a maternal cousin of the petitioner and an accomplice in the crime. His name was James Harland. There are two comments by James Harland which are at issue in this matter. The district court believed that Harland testified falsely with respect to, first, whether or not he had asked for consideration from the prosecution in exchange for his testimony, and second, whether or not he had been given a promise of consideration from the prosecution in exchange for his testimony. The respondent argues in this court that the district court failed to give the appropriate deference required under Section 2254 to the findings of the state appellate court on post-conviction appeal with respect to this false testimony issue. The post-conviction court found that there was no quid pro quo with respect to the testimony of Harland, and that Harland's testimony regarding asking for a deal from the prosecution was in fact vague. These findings were entitled to deference and should have been reviewed under the deferential standards of D1, 2254 D1, and also were factual determinations by the state court, which are entitled to a presumption of correctness under 2254 E1 unless they are rebutted by clear and convincing evidence. In this particular matter, with respect to the first of these questions, that is, whether or not there was a promise that was made to Harland in exchange for his testimony, two affidavits were presented in the state post-conviction court from the prosecutor in the case and from Harland's attorney regarding a discussion that was had prior to Harland's testimony. Harland wanted to obtain a plea negotiation prior to the defendant's trial, but the prosecutor refused to enter into plea negotiations with Harland. He told Harland through his counsel that if, in fact, Harland testified truthfully, and Harland was not the one who had fired the gun in this matter, that his cooperation would be considered by the prosecution and the court. It's respondent's position that this was not the equivalent of an inducement or promise, but was merely a recognition to Harland through his counsel that if he did testify truthfully and in cooperation at the trial, that that might benefit him at a future date. But certainly the prosecutor did not make any affirmative promises to take any type of action whatsoever, either a promise to take an unspecified action or a promise to take a specified action. And it's because this particular conversation between Harland's attorney and the prosecutor did not rise to the level of a promise or an inducement in exchange for Harland's testimony, that the district court was wrong in concluding that Harland testified falsely. Harland, in fact, did not have a promise that he would receive something in exchange for his testimony, and his testimony was truthful on that point.
Well, wasn't he promised consideration? Maybe that isn't much, but it is a promise, isn't it?
He was told, I think the phrase that was used in the affidavit was cooperation, that his cooperation would be considered. My position, Your Honor, is that in the context of the conversation between Harlan's counsel and the prosecutor in the case, that was merely a recognition of a simple truism with respect to witnesses testifying against one another in criminal trials. That is, if you're going to testify against one of your accomplices, you might hope that that is going to help you. And I think that the fact that the prosecutor, in telling Harlan through his counsel that his cooperation would be considered by the state and the court, was merely referring to that truism and not referring to a promise that his cooperation would indeed be considered. And I would point out that the prosecutor made a reference to consideration given by the trial judge in the matter when the prosecutor, in a pre-trial type of situation like this, has no authority to bind the trial judge or suggest that the trial judge will be bound and obligated to take.
Were those conversations between counsel, or was the defendant present for any part of them?
The record is not clear whether or not the defendant was, whether Mr. Harlan was actually present. The language that was used in the affidavits by both the prosecutor and Harlan's attorney suggested that the conversations were between counsel and that Harlan's attorney then relayed that to him. Whether or not Harlan was specifically sitting next to his attorney, I frankly believe the record is unclear with respect to that.
There was also a question asked, have you asked anything in return for your testimony?
That's correct, Your Honor. And that is the second point that the district court found that Harlan had testified falsely regarding. Certainly it is true that Harlan's counsel approached the prosecutor in an attempt to obtain a plea negotiation. I can't stand before you and deny that. My point to you is that that particular question, when looked at in the record, has to be viewed in the context of the series of questions that were being asked of Harlan on cross-examination. Because if you look to the questions that immediately preceded that and immediately followed that, you will see that the defendant's attorney in cross-examining Harlan used the phrase, that is, you asked your attorney about what type of a benefit you might receive. In other words, the petitioner's attorney directed Harlan not to the general issue of whether or not Harlan had approached the prosecution in some manner, but rather directed Harlan to talk about what he expected based upon his discussion with his counsel. And my argument is that that particular question cannot be viewed in a vacuum, that when it was heard by the jury and by the prosecutor in this case, since we're talking about the prosecutor's obligation to correct false testimony, that when they looked at that and heard the clarification that immediately followed that question, that it was clear that he was not talking about some type of general approach toward the prosecution. And in fact, that is, that sequence of questions and the fact that these questions were asked in that sequence was noted by the state post-conviction court on appeal when they made the finding that Harlan's testimony at that point was rather vague. And I would submit that that's true because of the direction that the question went in and the clarification that immediately followed. So the state post-conviction court, in concluding the post-conviction appeal, affirmatively found that there was no uncorrected perjured testimony at petitioner's trial. And my argument to this court is that the district court failed to give deference to that finding. The district court compared this case to two Supreme Court cases, which of course is required under B1, the provision of 2254, referencing decisions that are either contrary to or unreasonable applications of Supreme Court precedent. The first case that the district court found this matter to be comparable to was Bagley. Bagley was actually presented in the context of a Brady claim, though those analyses are quite similar. The factual circumstances of Bagley is very distinct from what we have here. The inducement that they were talking about in Bagley, or the failure to disclose in Bagley, was with respect to a contract that was signed by two witnesses, well, I should say two contracts, the same contract. There were two witnesses that testified on behalf of the prosecution in Bagley. They assisted in the investigation of the case. During the course of the investigation of the case, these witnesses signed two affidavits. And at the conclusion of each of those affidavits, there was an indication an affirmative indication by the witnesses that they have not been offered anything in exchange for their test or exchange for their cooperation and information. The problem was one of the affidavits was signed the day after each of these witnesses signed a blank contract, which purported to give them payment of, I believe, $300. It's not clear whether or not that $300 was directly payment for their own testimony or for their expenses in the case, but certainly there was an inducement there. The prosecution in that case deliberately did not sign that contract until after the trial was over and tried to make the argument that because there was no definitive agreement, that there was nothing that needed to have been disclosed. But the court disagreed. The Supreme Court disagreed with that and really viewed that as a contingent promise case, that there was a carrot that was being held out to these witnesses. And the form of that, there was a specific indication of what would happen after their testimony was given, and that that was enough of an inducement in that matter. That's not what we have here.
Okay, why don't you save the rest of your time for rebuttal?
Thank you, Your Honor.
Ms. Daniel?
May it please the court, counsel. Good morning, Your Honors. Karen Daniel from the Bloom Legal Clinic at Northwestern University School of Law, appearing for appellee Todd Harding. Before I begin my argument proper, I am compelled to point out a mistake in the brief that we filed. On page 16, we include a quote from the United States Supreme Court case of United States versus Bagley. It's on the second paragraph on that page. We attribute that quote to the Supreme Court as a whole. When I was reviewing my brief last night, I realized that, in fact, this particular quote comes from a part of the decision that was joined by only one justice other than the author of that opinion, and that should have been noted in our brief, and I apologize for the oversight, and to counsel as well. I would point out, though, that two justices who signed a dissenting opinion cited that same passage with approval, and the third dissenting judge also, at least impliedly, approved that passage as well, so it may indeed be considered a majority opinion of the court.
At least you've got strong help from the dissent.
Right. Nonetheless, I'd like to begin by just answering a factual question that was posed by the court during my opponent's argument, and the question was whether James Harland was present during the discussion between the prosecutor and his attorney, and the record does indicate in two places that he was present for that discussion. In his own affidavit and Harland's affidavit, he states that during those discussions between my attorney, Mr. Charos, and me, I was reassured that my testimony would benefit me in my case.
Well, that would be the attorney and the client, not the attorney and the prosecutor.
My attorney, and then Mr. Charos, that's the name of the prosecutor. So the discussions between my attorney, Mr. Charos, the prosecutor, and me. The other place where there's a reference to the individuals present at the meeting is on page 327 of the record during the direct examination of Mr. Harland by the prosecutor, Mr. Charos. He asked Mr. Harland, did you have occasion, this was after his arrest, after Mr. Harland's arrest, did you have occasion to come over to my office with your attorney? Yes. Further elaboration. So you remember coming over and telling me about this? Yes, sir. So by these questions and answers as well.
This is at the post-conviction hearing level?
No, this is at the trial. This is
the trial
on the,
itself.
This is on the trial and the direct examination of Mr. Harland. At the post-conviction level, there was no evidentiary hearing. The post-conviction matter was decided on summary judgment. So
based on the record of the trial itself?
Record of the trial and the affidavits, the three affidavits that were submitted during the post-conviction proceedings.
I have trouble seeing how the petitioner would actually have been benefited by full disclosure of everything that had happened, because full disclosure would show that there was no plea agreement. There was just this vague suggestion that if he cooperated, of course, you know, might be better off. He kind of hinted at that by when he made clear to the jury that he was, you know, he was at risk of being prosecuted for murder. So I just don't see how a jury would have been swayed by this additional disclosure.
Well, Your Honor, every time that Mr. Harlan was asked a direct question about his expectation of leniency in exchange for his testimony, he denied it. He was asked, do you think the penalties will be different if you testify? No. Do you think that the murder charge will be dropped against you? No. Is that why you're testifying? No. He was asked elsewhere in his testimony, did you think that it would help you if you told the police what you're telling us now? No, no, no. And furthermore, in the closing argument by the prosecutor, if he didn't state outright, he certainly implied very strongly that Mr. Harlan had nothing to gain from testifying. The prosecutor, on page 781 of the record, characterizes Mr. Harlan's testimony as, I'm guilty, but I didn't shoot him. I got nothing to gain.
When he's asked why he testified, he said, it just came to me that I had been arrested for a murder that I did not do. Doesn't that imply that by testifying he's trying to avoid being prosecuted for murder?
Not when expressly asked that question, he continually denies it. And when the prosecutor...
No, he repeated, you know, I just asked you if I'm going to get charged for a murder that I have not done. So wouldn't the jury think, well, this person is testifying in order to save himself from being convicted of murder?
Well, actually,
which is inducement, a strong inducement to testify.
At the time, the time frame I think that's being discussed here is, he says, in the passage Your Honor quoted, he says that he simply asked his attorney if he was going to get charged for a murder that he claimed he hadn't done. Well, he was charged. Now he is charged with that
right.
murder.
Right. So the jury knows that, and the jury knows that he has a strong incentive to shift the... to testify that not he, but the petitioner was the murderer, right? The jury knows that he has this inducement to lie.
Well, what they know is what he tells them, which is that...
You know, but just, if the jury has some common sense, they realize the person who's testifying is either the murderer or the, you know, accuser of the murderer. So he's going to testify that he isn't the murderer, whether or not it's true, right? So the jury realizes that, surely.
I don't think it can be...
The jury realizes he has an incentive to lie. That you acknowledge that much, surely.
Well, I frankly...
You wouldn't acknowledge that?
I don't acknowledge that the jury knows that. I know that. Your Honors know that. I think everyone in this courtroom knows that. But I don't think that the juries, in the face of evidence to the contrary, can be...
No, there's nothing to the contrary about it. This person is charged with murder. So his testimony is, not I'm not the murderer, it's just the person who's being tried. Now, doesn't the jury realize that it's in his self-interest to try to shift the blame from himself to the defendant?
Well, the jury in this case was instructed on felony murder. And I think if they looked at their own instructions, they would have realized that by his own testimony, he was admitting his guilt of felony murder. So in that sense... I don't know that they would have felt that he was benefiting himself. He was admitting guilt of murder.
But he said twice he didn't commit murder.
So the jury
would say, this fellow denies that he's a murderer. He's testifying against the defendant. It must be that he's trying to shift the blame from himself to the defendant.
He said he wasn't. He was charged with murder. He had admitted facts that, as the jury knew, made him guilty of murder, and he claimed that, no, he didn't think he was going to benefit from this testimony. Maybe the jury thought that he was just being altruistic or that he regretted his participation in this, that he was trying to make things right between himself and a higher power. But the only evidence that the jury had was that he was not hoping to benefit from this, and that was untrue. And the jury was unaware that he had sought a plea agreement, and that was untrue, as the prosecutor as the prosecutor well knew. The promise that he got from the prosecutor, while we can debate whether it was the prosecutor offered him a lot or a little, was a promise to consider his cooperation in disposing of the case. And an open-ended promise like that can actually provide even more of an incentive for a witness to embellish or even fabricate than a specific deal. Because in a case such as this, the witness understands that it's the prosecutor's satisfaction with the job he does at trial that's going to determine the magnitude of his reward. And
suppose the Illinois Appellate Court had said, we don't think a jury would be swayed by this kind of stuff. What weight would that be entitled to in our deliberations?
Well, that would be an unreasonable application of Supreme Court law, and the district court and this court would be entitled to grant habeas relief despite that finding. Because in the Supreme Court cases that have dealt with this type of false
testimony. No, there's no case like this in the Supreme Court.
That the jury would disregard knowledge that the witness had an incentive to provide testimony favorable to the state. Napius said
that.
No,
they all involve very different facts.
Well,
why couldn't a court say, look, yes, there was a failure to disclose a promise, but we just don't think a jury would have been swayed. Then you wouldn't have a violation of Brady, would you?
Well, we're not.
No prejudice.
Right.
You have to show prejudice.
We have to show prejudice.
So what if the court said we just don't think a jury would have been swayed by this?
Well, the United States Supreme Court has said in Napiu, in Giglio versus United States, in United States versus Bagley, that this is precisely the type of information that is crucial to a jury's determination of a witness's credibility, and it's precisely
an
incentive provided by the prosecutor to testify favorably to the state, and that if they know about such an inducement, that may in fact affect their decision.
Wait, how far would you press it? Suppose the prosecutor said, if you testify truthfully, I'll give you a chocolate bar.
Well, that's not much, but the jury's entitled to know that. But that's a far cry from
this
case.
Okay, wait, so you're saying that's a reversible error, too.
You're taking
a hard line.
Well, let's look at what happened in this case. He had a whole range of possible expectations based on his cooperation, and let's look at what he got. He got the murder charge dropped. He got a 10-year sentence, which under Illinois law translates to serving 4.5 years in prison as opposed to natural life, which is what Todd Harding got. That's on one end of the spectrum that he could hope for, and then in fact he did get. And that's a much greater inducement, I think, Your Honor, than a chocolate bar. And that's why this case is reversible, and maybe the chocolate bar case wouldn't be. Your Honors, we feel that the district court's opinion was well-reasoned. It was well within the deferential standards set forth in the federal habeas statute, and we ask Your Honors to affirm it. Thank you.
Okay, thank you, Ms. Daniel. Ms. Osterberger, how much time does she have? 4 minutes.
I'd like to touch first upon the factual issue that counsel I talked about with respect to the defendant, Mr. Harlan being present during the conversation. It still isn't clear whether or not he was present during the particular conversations that the affidavits made reference to. There's no question that there was some conversation, but whether or not there was more than one or that there was a separate conversation between the prosecutor and Harlan's counsel that Harlan wasn't present for, I don't necessarily think that's clear. Counsel is right when she points out that there are references in the record to Harlan talking to the prosecutor, but it's not clear that that's what the affidavits are talking about. Could have been, but it's not clear. One of the points that counsel touched upon, I think merits consideration by this court, which is that she referred to Harlan's expectation of leniency And that's a real problem in this type of case, because I would submit to the court that there's no Supreme Court precedent which requires a prosecutor to correct a subjective expectation of leniency. And that, being not having a Supreme Court precedent which requires the prosecutor to correct that type of subjective expectation of leniency, would really put the defendant out of the box in this case, because he's barred under Section D1, which requires you to point to Supreme Court precedent, and he's also barred under Teague if he's suggesting an expansion of constitutional rules on collateral review. It's different if the prosecutor hears the witness testify to something about the inducement, which might have led to whatever the expectation might be. And I would acknowledge that if, in fact, there was false testimony about whatever inducement it was, that would be subject to correction by the prosecutor. But to hold that the prosecutor was to be the gatekeeper or the judge of what these subjective expectations of leniency of witnesses are, I think it's an extension which is not warranted on habeas review.
That goes back to the question I asked you. Have you asked anything in return for your testimony? No, sir. And I guess your argument is that then they shifted to his expectation, not whether he asked the question.
That's right. And you have to consider the questions in context of one another. Given the fact that shift took place, that what I had termed a clarification, and Your Honor has referred to as a shift, the fact that took place had to be considered by the prosecutor as a whole when he's viewing what exactly Harlan was testifying to. The other thing I wanted to touch upon was that it appears from the petitioner's argument that there's some type of suggestion here that there's some type of per se reversal requirement under NAPU, and that's certainly not the case. So the Supreme Court precedent is quite clear that there can be a finding of harmlessness with respect to uncorrected perjured testimony. And under NAPU, the question is, of course, whether or not there was a reasonable likelihood that the false testimony could have affected the verdict. The court has talked many times about how that is very similar to the harmless beyond a reasonable doubt standard under Chapman. So to the extent that counsel is suggesting that there's some type of per se reversal requirement here, I would suggest that is simply not the case. I would be happy to answer any further questions that this court might have.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Osterberger and Ms. Osterberger and Ms. Daniel. And thanks to you and to Northwestern for accepting the appointment. And representing your client with great energy and confidence. Okay, our next case.